This is Top of Mind Prime Cuts. I'm Julie Rose. It's our weekly director's cut of the show, a selection of curated conversations from the archive. First this hour, the pollution crisis that nobody's talking about. Then, since most sexual assaults are perpetrated by an acquaintance, pepper spray and whistles are not much help. We'll hear about a safety bracelet designed from real-life experience. Also, why forgetting its special song is driving one Australian songbird toward extinction. It's coming up on Top of Mind Prime Cuts. Great to have you with us. Salt occurs naturally everywhere, but it's also one of the most useful and ubiquitous elements in human society. It's in our food, which also means it's in our waste. It's in our construction materials and fertilizers, and we dump tons of it on roads to keep them from icing over. Well, now all that salt is poisoning the world's fresh water supplies. University of Maryland professor Sujay Kaushal says the problem is verging on a global crisis and that we need to be tackling it on the same scale that we address air pollution or carbon emissions. Kaushal is a professor of Earth System Science and one of the most prolific researchers on this issue. I spoke with him back in the spring. First of all, why is salt so useful for humans?
Well, we need salt in our bodies. I mean, so it's something that we require. Also, we need salt, as you mentioned in the intro, for clearing roads and all kinds of different things. So it's a really essential, part of our daily lives.
And does it dissipate or disappear over time?
We used to think so. We published our first study on this about 15 years ago. And we thought that when salt was applied to roadways in particular, that it would just get flushed out and disappear and get washed away. But what we started to find was that basically it was accumulating in the environment, and it was accumulating in major drinking water supplies, and that surprised us. So we'd see salt, peak in the winter months in some of the streams, and it'd get to about 25% the level of salt that you see in seawater, which is pretty high. But what was surprising to us is that during the summer months, the salt concentration still stayed elevated. Mm. And so that was going up too. So that was, that was our first clue that it was being stored in the environment.
Is using it on roads the primary, the most worrisome use that is leading to this accumulation in the environment?
Yeah, good question, Julie. It is a major, major cause. You can see in a lot of places, this big pulse of salt that gets released in the winter. And what happens is it stays in the environment so that it trails off, but it lags for months and then, days and months. And then we've seen the baseline levels of salt, like I said, during summer months, keep on increasing because of the accumulation. But one thing we didn't know 15 years ago was that there are these other sources of salts that are also issues that are, sometimes water softeners, fertilizers that we apply to agricultural fields, concrete breaking down parking lots and pavements. We didn't think about that. I mean, we think about building new roads, but we didn't think about what happens when those roads break down. And some of the material in the roads are calcium and carbonates and other salt ions that get washed into waters also, which makes this problem even more urgent because not only do you have the road salt issue, but you have all these other sources of salts that are also contributing to the problem.
We've used the word salt, and I guess I just think salt is like the kind that makes the sea salty, or it's the table salt kind of stuff. And I think that those are pretty close to the same thing because I think we get table salt from the sea a lot of times. So are there other kinds of salts that we're talking about here when you start talking about what comes out of concrete as it breaks down or what's put on farmlands?
Yeah, good question. So when we think of salt, we think of sodium chloride, which is what you're referring to, Julie. And that's the dominant salt in the ocean too. But in that ocean water and in other, in other forms of salt, you have basically these – what makes a salt is that it has ions in it, which are charged particles. So if you took the sodium and chloride, like say that you're eating dinner tonight and you take the salt and you sprinkle it, it's got little crystals. You put it in the water and it dissolves.
Mm-hmm.
And so when it dissolves into these charged particles. One's positive, the sodium is positive, and the chloride is negative. So there are other crystals that we have that we use, like calcium carbonate or calcium sulfate, that are crystalline, like sodium chloride, like what you put on your food. They dissolve in water, forming these charged particles. And so all those are salt ions. And those different salt ions, what we're starting to realize is that they have different effects in the environment, those mixtures of those salt ions. So people first started noticing that, you know, we started noticing that the sodium and chloride were increasing. Then we started realizing that, oh my gosh, the sulfate, the calcium, all these other ions were increasing in the water along with the sodium and chloride. And they have different mixes and interactive effects. It's kind of like sometimes, I'm trying to think of an analogy. Sometimes if you, like we know now that smoking can be bad for health, right? And so sometimes when people smoke, there are health risks associated with that. But if they're also drinking or eating certain types of foods, those interact with each other to compound health risks.
Okay.
So these different ions can, have different environmental impacts and interact with each other.
Impacts that go beyond just making stuff salty? Because the obvious, I suppose, on one level, the obvious effect would be if you say that at least in the wintertime, you know, the baseline levels of saltiness in freshwater streams where the runoff is coming from the salted roads could get to like 50% as salty as the ocean. That's what you said, right?
Yeah, some streams, yeah.
Okay,
for sure.
Okay. So for me, it seems obvious to me that the consequence of that would be the water is saltier, and so that might kill some plants, like when I sprinkle, when you dump salt on your lawn and it dies, or maybe some animals would find that not, like, I can't just go drink salt water. That's going to cause problems in my body, right? So,
right.
So are the problems that you're talking about, the impacts, primarily around that, just the fact that salt water doesn't work as well as fresh water in a lot of cases? Or are there other rippling effects?
Yeah, that's a really good and perceptive question, actually. I mean, you would think that basic issue is the main problem, and it is. You know, I mean, it's 50% the salinity of seawater in these really urban streams. And you're right, like, if you went home and you, for dinner, instead of sprinkling the salt on, you ate a bunch of chips, and, you know, your mouth would be thirsty for that, because basically salt dries things out. So those are some of the effects that you're talking about with killing plants and, you know, frogs and amphibians with like moist skin or bugs. So those salt stresses are really important for animals and plants. And we even see some invasion of saltwater species actually in some of these urban areas where there's a lot of road salt and salt issues. But one thing that we discovered, and this is fairly recently, within the last like 5 years, I mean, over time, we've discovered all these different things. Like the rippling effect that you're talking about is a really great analogy, because what we found out is that these salt ions actually mobilize all these other contaminants, like radionuclides and toxic metals and nutrients that cause pollution in lakes and rivers. And what happens is, and we didn't know this at the time, but because those ions are charged particles, remember we were talking about sodium and chloride, sodium has a positive charge. And what happens is that a lot of toxic metals, they also have a positive charge. And radionuclides that are radioactive, like radium, they're also positively charged. Soils are conveniently negatively charged, believe it or not, and mud at the bottom of streams. And so opposites attract. And so those metals and radionuclides stick to those particles. And what happens is when you put dump these salts in the environment, especially sodium. Sodium is a small ion, small charged particle that has the unique ability to dislodge all these metals and radionuclides and release them into the water. And that's a process that we call ion exchange, where it basically replaces the metals and contaminants on the soil and mud, puts them into the water. And that, you know, that can get into drinking water supplies, that can cause effects to aquatic life. There's all kinds of different rippling effects, like you say, Julie, where you add these ions, and then they cause other things to get dislodged and displaced and then release them into the water.
So what problems, I mean, is there anywhere in the world where this has become such a problem that it's actively affecting people's ability to get water for drinking or for agriculture or for other freshwater purposes?
Sure. I mean, all kinds of different places. So even in our, one of the things where we talked about, you know, as the salts move through the soils and mud, but it also moves through drinking water pipes. And in drinking water pipes and in home wells where there's copper pipes or old iron pipes, it can actually mobilize, it can actually release metals or corrode the pipe so that you get metals in the drinking water.
Like lead. So,
yeah, like lead, like manganese, like copper. I mean, this is all new recent stuff that we just didn't know that 15 years ago. But, you know, my own house was contaminated from a road salt issue in the D.C. metropolitan area. I was interviewed by the Washington Post maybe a couple years ago, 2015, I'm not sure. And our water was turning blackish brown in the area. And the report from the Post was like, Sujay, why is this water, you know, turning color? And I was like, it's because it's, you know, leaching from the pipe. There's manganese in these old iron pipes and the salty water from the winter. This wasn't even during winter, Julie. This was in spring when this was happening. And I was like, you know, the salt's interacting with the old pipes and releasing it. My neighbor came over after the interview and said, Sujay, did you notice that our water, why has our top tap water been turning black for the last, you know, 4 or 5 weeks? And I was like, oh my gosh, this is happening at home. And my son was like, you know, 30 pounds. He was like, I don't know, 3 years old or something like that. And kids are about 90% water at that age. And I was like, I'm going to go to Home Depot and install a reverse osmosis system because this is not good. And then I also called our water supplier because we do research and work with them. And I asked them to come to our neighborhood and flush all the lines in our part of the neighborhood so that it flushed all the pipes so that my neighbors weren't affected.
So it could be happening. Clearly is in communities all around the country and around the world. Oh, yeah. Is it affecting, I mean, do we have ways to treat the water? So even if it is 50% as salty as the ocean at certain times of the year, you know, or if your well is a little saltier than it ought to be for you to drink it, do we have ways to treat water so that we can still access that as fresh water?
Yeah, those are a couple good questions. So just, you know, with the agricultural example, I mean, you look at some of the ancient civilizations, they were affected by salinization, like the use of like irrigation water and then how that salinized the soil. That affected their crops and those ancient great civilizations that we had, you know, in the Middle East and other places. So it's been a historical issue. It's just we expected those things to happen in dry areas, dry and semi-arid areas where there's just not a lot of rainwater. Mm. Now we're discovering that it's happening in all these humid areas where there's plenty of rainwater. So that's what's one of the reasons why it's making it widespread. Now, what can we do about it? You're right, Julie. It's affecting people. Sometimes a lot of the reason why I'm happy to be on your show and I'm happy that you're tackling this subject is people aren't always aware of their of what's going on with their water. I mean, there are these salt ions are not federally regulated. Okay, that's one thing, and we don't know all the effects and implications yet either. But it's not something that you can easily remove during the treatment process. And the other part of it, too, is that when people are on home wells, they don't always get their water tested, right, like we do if we live in a city. So you could be drinking from that home well for X number of decades, and you could get, you know, release of copper from pipes and be subjected to you know, the impacts of this and not even know it. So I appreciate you you know, you having me on the show and talking about these issues for that so people are aware of their water. Now, what you can do about it, you can, you know, even those Brita filters or those different things that you have in your house, those can remove, varying degrees of efficiency, those can remove some of these metals and salts. Even in those types of filters, reverse osmosis wastes a lot of water. Like we have that in our house now, but it uses a lot of water. That's another way. So there are some things that you can do. I think one of the most important things that you can do is a lot of when you wake up in the morning and the water that sits in the pipes, it's had plenty of time to interact with the pipes. And so if you flush your pipes in the morning, like you run the water for a little while, run your washing machine, flush your toilets, basically that gets the water moving through the pipe system, and all that old water that was in the pipes, it flushes out, and so you get water that's had less time to interact and sit in the pipes, if that makes sense.
It does. And finally, Professor Kaushal, if you could speak to the global issue here, one of the arguments you make in some of the work you've been publishing is that we need to consider this, you know, a global problem on the level of acid rain or on the level of air pollution. What would a global response to it be, given that salt is so ubiquitous in everything we do, like you described?
Yeah, so it's a problem that affects different regions of the globe. I would say, like, acid rain was a regional problem, but it was happening in different parts of the globe. And I'd say salinization is the same kind of thing, where some regions are hit harder than others. So I think, you know, you can develop, I think it's definitely possible to make progress in this area, especially in certain regions, when you identify, like, what the main culprits are for the salt issue. I mean, we talked about road salt. One of the things with road salt is that obviously we need it to keep our roads safe. That's really important. I mean, we don't want anybody to get hurt. We don't want anybody to, you know, get in an accident. That's really important. But the ways that we apply that salt, we can think about that. Like, for example, we have a lot of aging roads and infrastructure in the United States. And not only do we have aging roads and bridge infrastructure, but we also have aging salt trucks, right, that spread the salt. And some of those aging trucks don't have calibration systems where you can deliver a known quantity of salt onto the road. Mm. They just dump it on the road. And so we need to upgrade those trucks and calibrate for how much salt we actually need at certain temperatures and then spread it at that rate. I think that's an important thing. I think... we can, for example, with road salt, that's an easier one. We can, instead of putting it on the ground as a granular form sometimes with the salt crystals, we can wet it and make it a brine, and so it sticks on the ground and is more effective that way. And by the way, the way that salt works in de-icing, Julie, is that when water freezes, those water molecules get close together and scrunch together and form a crystal, which is like the snowflake that you would see on your hand when it's snowing. What happens is the salt ion wedges itself in between the water, so it prevents the water molecules from joining and forming a crystal. And so there are different salt ions of different sizes, like sodium and calcium, magnesium. Those are different size ions that wedge themselves in between the water when it's freezing to prevent the ice crystal from forming. Those different salts work best at different temperatures. So we can also think about, what the different temperatures are going to be like, what ions, what different types of salt mixes we should put on to prevent ice formation.
It sounds like it all just really starts with recognizing that salt is not harmless and that it doesn't just disappear. And if we can start from that understanding, we can start being a lot more mindful about how and when and why we're using it.
I think you're right. Ultimately, it comes down to how much we're using, right, and putting down on the ground. I mean, I think that's the basic message.
Sujay Kaushal is a professor of Earth System Science at the University of Maryland. I spoke with him back in April. This is Top of Mind Prime Cuts. It's our weekly director's cut of the show. So good to have you with us. Coming up in about 15 minutes, a songbird in Australia is forgetting how to sing its special song. Can scientists help the regent honey eater get its groove back? Just ahead, a bracelet that can help a woman get out of a dicey social situation without escalating things. Thanks for tuning in today to Top of Mind Prime Cuts. Once a week, the Top of Mind team combs through the archives to select conversations we'd like to hear again. The majority of sexual assaults reported to the National Crime Victimization Survey are cases where the victim knew her attacker. And in those instances, standard safety devices like pepper spray, whistles, brass knuckles just don't make a lot of sense. Sarah DeZariga and her business partner Quinn Fitzgerald know from personal experience that sometimes the key to preventing a sexual assault is giving a woman a way to get out of an unsafe situation without making a scene or escalating things. I spoke with Sarah DeZariga in March about the solution they have developed, which is called the Flare Bracelet. It's a top of mind prime cut. Describe how this bracelet works to help a woman.
Yeah. Well, Flare is an inconspicuous and powerful piece of technology and software that's hidden inside of everyday things, starting with a line of jewelry that helps you get out of a bad situation whenever you need it.
Okay. All right. So it's a bracelet. You've got a bunch of different designs, but let's say that I'm wearing the silver metal cuff. It just looks like a pretty bracelet from the outside, but there's some technology and a button, a Bluetooth kind of communication device that's underneath hidden on the inside of the bracelet, right? What happens when I push that button?
Right. Well, it's incredibly discreet so that, like you said, you're just wearing a bracelet and you're always protected without anybody else knowing that you're wearing it. And there's a little technology module that fits inside every bracelet that we offer. And there are over 20 different styles, like the silver cuff that you mentioned, so that you can pick something that matches your lifestyle and mm-hmm. blends in. And there's a little button on the side of that bracelet. And when you press the button, it works via Bluetooth with the Get Flare app on your phone.
Okay.
And that app will allow you to have access to three different options at the moment. You can press and hold down the button for 3 seconds, and we'll send your GPS location in a message to the friends and family that you select in our app, letting them know that you need someone to check in on you. And potentially some help. Then there's also an optional 911 feature that you can enable if that fits your needs and your lifestyle. That's not what everyone wants, but it is very important to some people's lifestyle. And I think that's an important aspect of how we approach safety. So if you enable that 911 option, when you hold down the button for 3 seconds, we'll also share your live GPS location and a message with first responders who will call you. And if you can answer the phone, then you can give them a little more information about what's happening, a little more context. But even if you can't answer the phone, they'll still send a dispatcher to your location. And then the feature that I really like is one press. If you press down on that button for just one tap and release, you'll get an automated phone call from Flare. And that seems like an odd safety feature at first.
Right.
It's actually really important to the way that people experience safety and the kind of help that they need. It creates an interruption if you're in a bad situation and the momentum is moving in a direction that you're not comfortable with and you need an interruption or a way to exit that situation safely and gracefully.
Let's pause and just explore that a little bit more. Anyone who has maybe not been in the situation where they're like, I can't get out of this situation, might be having some trouble kind of understanding what good this would do. So in the case that you're describing where you push the button once and it basically makes your phone in your pocket ring or in your purse. Right. Why would that be any more helpful than just like pretending to get a text message and then leaving?
Yeah, because it's truly a real interruption. I'm a survivor and so is my co-founder. So we've experienced this situation ourselves and we tried to design a solution that we wish we had in our situations. And then we talked to thousands of survivors about their experiences and what they would need. And what we heard from people time and time again was they needed an excuse and an interruption that gave them a moment to stand up and walk out of a bad situation. Because like you said, in the introduction, most of the time assault is perpetrated by someone that you know, and that person often has power or authority over you. And while some women feel comfortable speaking out and saying something and taking action if they're in a bad situation, not all women do, and no two situations are the same. Sometimes speaking out can agitate the other person and put yourself in more danger, or it could hurt your relationship with them in a way that you can't afford to jeopardize because they have power over you, like a boss, a member of your community, a coworker, a member of your family, unfortunately. And so people want the ability to have an excuse to get up and leave that doesn't look like they're taking action, especially in case they misread the situation. That's really inconspicuous, and that's important for their safety.
Okay, so in that case, maybe faking a text message would that you just got a text message and I have to go would be harder than actually, it would be helpful to actually get a phone call. And so you press the button once, and then it doesn't just make your phone ring, an actual phone call comes to you. Who's on the other end of it when I answer that phone call?
Yeah, it's an actual phone call. We have a suite of different voice actors and scenarios that are recordings that you'll experience. And so it's a real phone call, and you can program the number that it comes from to be whatever name you want in your phone, something that's believable. And then when the phone rings, you can pick it up and you can play along with the recording on the other end. We have options like your boyfriend or husband calling to check in because you have arranged to do something and they're ready to come pick you up. Your roommate telling you that there's a problem at your apartment and you need to come home that minute, or an emergency at home. They all create these really believable and short little situations that you can play along with. Mm-hmm. And if the other person were listening, it would sound completely real and you can just stand up and walk away with no blowback to yourself.
Yeah. Huh. Yeah, interesting. I wouldn't have thought that there would be such a need for this kind of cloak and dagger situation to help women. What's the scenario, do you think, the most common scenario where this bracelet, where that feature would be useful to someone? Like more like a college party type situation?
A lot of different scenarios. Definitely the college situation. We've heard people use it. People have used it with online dating when they go on a date and they meet somebody who turns out to not be who they said they were or is giving them a bad vibe. Women use it when they are walking by themselves and they have to approach a group of people and they want to appear busy. Like, appearing busy can be an important way of keeping yourself safe, looking like you are talking to and engaging with someone else when you need to. But really all safety situations are a bit different, which I think is something that you're touching on. And really what we wanted to do was give people the ability to have options in the moment, because no one can really read what will help you in the moment better than you. You're the person who's there. And flair is not meant to be the solution to safety or to assault, but the ability to de-escalate if you need to is a really important one. And the ability to have options as well, because you can also escalate by contacting your friends and family or the police if you want to. We think that optionality is really important.
Let's talk about the contacting friends and family piece. So what are the choices that I make when I'm setting that up before I go out?
Yeah, you can sync our app with your contacts in your phone, and you can pick up to 5 friends or family members to add to a group that we call your crew. And those are the people who will message when you activate it. They'll get your GPS location and a message that first says, like, hey, can you call and check in on Julie? She needs somebody to check in on her. So the first thing that will usually happen is your friends and family will call you or text you. And if they don't hear from you, then they have all the information that they need to escalate it if they need to. They can come to your location or they could share that information with someone else.
Okay. And is there a way to call off the dogs if I accidentally bumped it, or if maybe I realized everything's okay or I was able to get myself out of the situation?
Yes, absolutely. Okay. That's very important. It doesn't happen very often. We've designed it intentionally so that it's very difficult to activate accidentally. But if you did, when you activate it, you get a little secret notification from Flair so that you know that it went out, but nobody else knows. It doesn't say on your phone, you sent out a Flair alarm to your friends and family. We send you a little notification that you can design that says, like, reminder, 8 a.m. appointment tomorrow morning. Mm. And when you get that message, you just know that it went out. So if you see that on your phone, you can open the app and cancel it. Obviously, if your friends and family call you, you can tell them it was just an accident. And if you were to activate the 911 feature by accident, that's totally okay, because first an intermediary dispatcher is going to call you, and so you can always cancel it then, and that's totally fine. We encourage people to test the device, actually, because I think it's important to try it out with your friends and family and to try it out for yourself so that you know how it works and you're really comfortable using it when you need to.
Sarah Dizaraga, do you have any concern that this would give potentially give women a sense of security that would maybe encourage them to take more risks in terms of what situations they put themselves in?
Yeah, I mean, I could understand why you would think that. We haven't seen that. You know, an important part of FLAIR is we think about safety holistically, and we talk about it holistically with our community as well. We want FLAIR to be one more tool in your arsenal of tools that are available to you to help keep yourself safe. You still need to use your head and your gut. That's something that my mom always taught me. That's very important to how I navigate the world. And you want to use your voice in the moments when you can and you should. And you want to protect yourself in the ways that are appropriate to you in that moment. But it's very difficult to anticipate what's going to happen to you or to control the actions of others. So what we wanted to do is give you options, because you never know when you might need them. And we wanted to design something that really filled this gap for people, an alternative to pepper spray or an alarm or just a panic button.
And how did you and your business partner, Quinn, end up working together on this particular issue?
Yeah, we met when we were students at Harvard Business School. We were section mates, and we really bonded over our shared experience with sexual assault and the belief that business, because we were at business school, could be a tool to really solve some of the most pressing problems that people were experiencing in a way that was sustainable, could support employees and provide money to the business while also really making an impact on people's lives. We think those are the best kind of businesses out there. And, you know, we looked at the personal safety space, and we were really disappointed by what we saw. FLAIR is designed to be a tool that can help you in ways that other tools can't. You know, because in reality, like you said, most assault either happens with someone you know, or it happens in a slow, creeping way where someone else is continually eroding their boundaries, and it's hard to pinpoint the moment you're in danger. And an important part of how we designed this when we started working together was, you know, not making assumptions that we had all the answers or that our experiences were representative of everyone else's, but by working with survivors to share their stories and to listen to what they wanted and needed. That's something that the personal safety industry has never done before. We worked with nonprofits, advocates, service providers, and lawyers throughout the entire life of FLAIR. The Boston Rape Crisis Center and Respond Inc. were two local nonprofits that we did some of our first interviews and focus groups with to listen to survivors and what they were telling us that they needed. And we work with a myriad of support organizations through donations and promotions, where we give them part of our proceeds, or we provide them with discounted product as well as an advisory panel of experts who help advise us on what's going on in this space.
That's Sarah Dizaraga, co-founder of FLAIR. I spoke with her back in the spring. This is Top of Mind Prime Cuts. I'm Julie Rose. Coming up next, why forgetting its special song is driving one Australian songbird toward extinction. This is Top of Mind Prime Cuts. Thank you for tuning in today. It's great to have you. I'm Julie Rose. The Regent Honeyeater is a little bright yellow songbird native to Australia, and it is on the verge of extinction. In the meantime, Regent Honeyeaters are forgetting how to sing their song. And if the male birds can't sing the right song, they can't attract a female mate very well, so the spiral toward extinction accelerates. Russ Crates is on a team of researchers at Australian National University working on ways to help the Regent Honeyeaters get their groove back. I spoke with him in the spring. It's a Top of Mind Prime Cut. How did you discover that these birds were having trouble with their songs?
It was by accident, actually. We set out to start a new monitoring program for the species in 2015. And the idea was really just to go out and find out where the birds were surviving, where they were trying to breed, what was causing their nests to fail, that sort of thing. But shortly after we found the first birds, we noticed that some of them were singing these weird songs, which was really interesting because, you know, obviously birds normally have a song that's kind of unique to their own species. So to find some individuals singing other species songs was really interesting. So basically we decided that we would record the songs of all the males that we came across to see whether it led to something interesting. And this led to the research that we published a short time ago.
Let's listen to the traditional song, the correct song, whatever we want to call it, of the Regent Honey Eater, which is some audio that you have recorded and provided for us. Before we listen to it, what should we be listening for?
Yeah, this is the song of the birds that live in the Blue Mountains. So this is the area west of Sydney. This is the core remaining breeding range of the species. We think there's probably between 150 to maybe 200 birds in this area. So this recording that we'll hear is the birds that how they should be singing. And it's kind of like a mix of like a real strange little warbly, almost turkey-like kind of, it includes bill snaps and it's just kind of like a bit of a crescendo of a guttural warble.
The little sort of snapping noise, that's their bill. That's part of the song.
That's correct. Yeah, that's their bill.
Okay, and a honey eater, how would I know if I came across one, how would I know that I was looking at a regent honey eater?
They're really beautiful birds. They have this amazing bright yellow tail. Their chest is kind of black and white scalloped with these kind of little V shapes. And their wings are this amazing kind of patchwork of black and yellow as well. And they have this really weird face. They have bare skin around their eyes. Hmm. Which is kind of filled with tiny little warts there. It's pretty disgusting, actually. But we think that's because these birds feed on nectar from trees in flower, that the warts or the bare skin is a kind of an adaptation to stop the feathers around their eyes from becoming covered in pollen and causing them trouble.
And the song that we were just hearing, how would a regent honey eater typically learn that song? They're not born sort of innately knowing that I'm supposed to make these little clicks and do this little warble.
That's correct. Yeah. So most songbirds learn their songs in the same way that humans learn to speak their language. And so what happens is when the young birds fledge from their nest, they'll disperse, they'll get chased away by their parents because the parents will often try to have a second brood. And then at that point, it's up to the young males to go and find other birds in the landscape to hang around with, listen to those birds singing, and then kind of learn that song. And so the regent honey eaters have a real kind of really important window in their lives between the ages of about 1 month and 9 months of age, where that's their kind of song learning period. And after that period, they'll refine their songs, and that will be the song that they're left with for the rest of their life.
And their dad won't teach it to them. Because the parents chase the boys out. That's, okay.
So that's correct. And when the birds are nesting, the parents are completely quiet because, obviously if they're singing away while they've got chicks or eggs in the nest, it's a kind of an advert to predators. Oh, here we are. We're over here. Come and eat us. So the parents are pretty much silent when they're raising their chicks.
And do only the males sing? And is it only for mating?
The females do make vocalizations, but the song, how we're defining the song in our study, is only produced by the males.
Okay. And only for mating, or is it also for other purposes?
No, it's also really important for kind of establishing territories. So when these birds turn up to their breeding sites in the spring, they'll find, one of their favorite food tree species that's in really heavy bud and about to flower, and they'll stick by these trees and they'll sing their hearts out and basically say to other males that this is my tree, you can't nest here.
So here again is the correct song, the traditional song of the regent honey eater. But what you have discovered, Ross Crates, is that There are honey eaters, a lot of honey eaters, that are singing other birds' songs. They're not singing the song of their own species.
That's correct, yeah. So we found about, we found 18 males, which represents about 12% of the adult male population in the wild, that had learned to sing the songs of other bird species. So they sounded nothing like a region honey eater.
We have a couple of examples. So here's one that's a regent honey eater, but it's singing like something called a little wattle bird. It's like, it's nothing like it. There's like no, hardly any warbles. It's just a bunch of squawking. That's so strange. And how would that have happened? How would a regent honey eater have picked up that song?
Well, so little wattle birds primarily occur on the coast, on the east coast of Australia. So what we think is happening with these regent honey eaters that have learned these songs is that they've fled from their nest. They've kind of migrated to the coast to spend the winter. And because they haven't been able to find any other regent honey eaters, because there's so few of them and they're so sparsely distributed, that this particular male regent honey eater has decided he's going to make friends with little wattle birds. And then basically he's just learned to sing like one of them instead of a regent.
Here's another one of a regent honey eater singing another bird's song. That bird's called a little friar bird, is that right?
Yeah, that's right, yeah. So okay. This particular male turned up on the breeding grounds early in the spring, and we watched him for about 6 weeks. So he was hanging around with other regent honey eaters that sang correctly, and he had no idea what he should be singing, even though he had other birds there. So what we think with that particular male is that he dispersed away from the breeding grounds, decided to hang around with the little friar bird, learned the little friar bird song, and subsequently refound regent honey eaters to hang around with. But because his song was already fixed at that point, it was too late for him to use those males that he had subsequently found to learn his song.
Oh, okay, because the window, like you said, the window of learning happens just in a very kind of limited...
Yeah, the window had passed for that particular male.
And so what happens then for that male?
Interestingly, he was actually paired. So what we found through our research, through monitoring the nests of all the wild birds that we could find, is that males that sing unusual songs, so by unusual we mean other species songs or songs that still sounded like a regent honey eater that were sort of atypical for the area, or a simplified version of a regent honey eater song. These males were less likely to be paired to a female, and the paired males were less likely to nest. So we think it's kind of associated with some sort of fitness cost to sing these unusual songs. But this particular male, he was actually paired to a female, but unfortunately they didn't breed successfully that.
But how would, are the female honey eaters born knowing how to recognize the song of a honey eater? Because if the boys are having trouble learning it, you would think that the females would also have trouble having heard the correct song. So it wouldn't seem to matter that much if the one that they mate with isn't quite singing it right.
Yeah, it's a really good question. In some ways, yeah, we assume that the females have to be exposed to the normal song to know what they should be listening out for. And so what we think might be happening with these with the females that are paired up with these males that sing other species songs is they never have a reference. So in the same way that the males don't know what they should be singing, the females don't know what they should be listening out for. But having said that, there is a proportion of the female population, particularly the ones that live in these, the largest kind of remaining breeding areas, so the Blue Mountains, that would have spent their lives kind of exposed to the traditional songs of regent honey eaters and would know what they should be listening out for. Those are the sort of females that we think would be, if they have a choice, more likely to avoid these weird sounding males. Hmm.
Do other birds learn the songs of other species of birds? Is this at all common to see cross species singing like this?
No, it's definitely not common. Bird songs have evolved because they play these really important roles in attracting mates, or attracting, maintaining territories, and other, communicating with your own species. So it's certainly not something that's beneficial. There are a couple of examples. So in North America, there's a published example of a prairie warbler that had learned the song of a sparrow. And also in Hawaii, there was a paper published a couple of years ago that showed that three species of honey creepers, so not honey eaters, honey creepers, their songs had kind of converged on each other because of habitat loss in Hawaii. Mm. Had made these species kind of co-occur more than they would do naturally. What we found in Regent Honeyeater is kind of unprecedented in the scale of loss of this song culture.
I'm speaking with Ross Kreitz, who's a postdoctoral fellow in the Difficult Bird Research Group at Australian National University. Difficult Bird Research Group, meaning that birds that face difficulties, or are Regent Honeyeaters difficult in some other way?
Well, there's both, actually. Yeah, the name of our group is kind of tongue-in-cheek in the sense that they're species that are difficult to study. Mm. But you're right, they also do face difficulties. So other species that we study are things like swift parrots. So swift parrots breed in Tasmania, an island off of the southern tip of mainland Australia, and then they migrate to the mainland. Similar to Regent Honeyeaters, they have a huge range. They don't breed in the same places year after year, and there's very few of them. There's probably less than 2,000 swift parrots. There's probably less than 300 Regent Honeyeaters. So by difficult, what we mean is they're species that they're really hard to monitor and hard to do science on because of their particular kind of ways of living.
Mm. And because of their serious decline. Did Regent Honeyeaters... Were they ever really common, really numerous in Australia?
Yeah. So John Gould was one of the first naturalists that kind of explored Australia in the 1700s. Looking back over his notes, he said that Regent Honeyeaters were one of the most abundant birds he saw, and they used to roam the landscape in immense flocks, containing hundreds or even thousands of individuals. So in some ways, it's really sad to think that there's probably less Regent Honeyeaters left in the world than there were in a single flock, maybe less than 100 years ago.
And what's led to their decline?
Land clearing is the major issue for Regent Honeyeaters. So their favorite food tree species, there's only three or four of them, and they're eucalyptus trees, so gum trees that grow on really particularly fertile soils. And because they grow on fertile soils, they flower very profusely and they produce a lot of nectar. And that's what the Regent Honeyeaters feed on. They feed their nestlings nectar as well. Unfortunately, however, these areas with good soils, as you can imagine, are the areas that are favored for agriculture. So over the last 100 years or so, the Regent Honeyeaters probably lost in the region of over 90% of its breeding habitat. Mm. So that's the main reason why the population has declined so much. And the other reason that's kind of confounding that is that they're competing for what's left in terms of flowering trees or their preferred habitat with other bird species, many of which are bigger than Regent Honeyeaters. So back in the good old days, what they would have done was roamed in these big flocks, and they would have compensated for their small body size by safety in numbers. And what we find is as the population declines, becomes less, more sparsely distributed, the flocks are becoming smaller and smaller. And that makes Regent Honeyeaters less competitive for access to the best breeding spots and the best feed trees compared to all the other bird species they're kind of competing against.
And then you got this song problem, adding insult to injury for a lot of males that can't seem to, that will have a much harder time successfully mating if they can't sing the right song.
That's exactly it. Yeah.
And would you tell us, Ross Kreitz, about the efforts that your group is undertaking to try to teach? You've got captive birds, right? You're raising some of these Regent Honeyeaaters in captivity. How are you trying to teach them to sing correctly so that when they get out into the wild, they will be successful?
Yes, there's a captive breeding program that's been run by Taronga Conservation Society for about 15 years now. What we found really interestingly is that the captive males have their own unique song type that's completely different to all of the wild males.
We actually have a bit of audio of that. Let's just listen real quick. So this is the captive bred Regent Honeyeater song. Okay, so somehow in the captive breeding facility, they've developed their own song.
Yes, they have developed their own song. And what we what we're trying to do is make these captive males sing more like the wild males should be singing, in the hope that if we can do that, that we'll make the captive males more attractive to the wild females. And so what we've done is we've kind of made a little bit of a mixtape of the wild males we've recorded through our study that sing a good song, like the correct song, as we're defining it. And we're playing those mixtapes to the juvenile males in captivity. So they're being exposed to what they should be singing. And we're hoping over the next few months that they'll acquire these songs themselves and sound more like the wild males.
Are you isolating them, though, from the males that sing the wrong song? Or you're just hoping that the correct song somehow resonates more with these juveniles as they learn?
We've isolated the young males from the older males that sing, the captive song type.
Yeah.
What we've also done is two wild males were recruited to the captive breeding program to help boost the genetic integrity of the captive population, and both of those males sing good Blue Mountains songs. And so we're using those two wild males. They're extremely valuable individuals. We're using those birds. We've put them in with the captive, young captive males. And we're hoping that having live tutors as well as the playback will help these young males to sing better songs.
Ross Kreitz is a postdoctoral fellow with the Difficult Bird Research Group at Australian National University. We spoke back in April. Top of Mind is a production of BYU Radio. Spirituality doesn't seem like something that hard science would have much to say about, but recently on Top of Mind, we spoke with a researcher who's found proof in brain scans that humans are hardwired to experience transcendence. Those who tap into that brain capacity regularly are less likely to experience depression. Explore the science of spirituality with us on the Top of Mind podcast, or find the conversation at byuradio.org/topofmind. I'm Julie Rose. This is Top of Mind Prime Cuts. I'm Julie Rose. Every week, the Top of Mind team combs through the archives to select conversations that deserve another listen. We're excited about what we have for you today. This hour, the story of the British Channel Islanders who endured years of Nazi occupation and still managed to resist. Also, what if a peace memorial were built on the National Mall alongside the others there honoring war veterans? Then the heart is not just the symbolic center of our emotions. Its rhythm actually affects emotions. Good to have you with us today for Top of Mind Prime Cuts. The Channel Islands were the only part of the British Isles occupied by Nazi Germany during World War II. They sit in the English Channel off the coast of France. The largest are Jersey and Guernsey. The Nazi occupation of those islands lasted 5 years, most of the war. Jenny Lecote was born in Jersey not long after the war ended, and grew up hearing stories of her family's resistance efforts during the occupation. Now Lecote has turned the true stories of two women who were part of that resistance into her first novel. It's called The Girl from the Channel Islands. We spoke at the first of this year. Let's talk about your family's story first. You wrote a movie about them. It's called Another Mother's Son. Tell us about your great aunt, Louisa Gould.
Well, Louisa Gould, as you say, was my great aunt. And what was extraordinary about my family was that they hid these Russian slave workers who were brought over by the Nazis in their own homes. My great aunt was, she was a Christian woman, and she'd lost her own son earlier in the war. And I think that what she was concerned about was helping another mother's son, hence the title of the film. So she took this guy in when he escaped from his camp, because these guys were treated really badly. I mean, worse than animals. And when they managed to escape from their captors, there was no way off the island. So she took him in, and some other members of the family took in another prisoner. And she kept him there almost as a son for 2 years, and looked after him and formed a relationship with him. Unfortunately, they were betrayed. And both my great aunt and my great uncle ended up in concentration camps. So it was a tragic story, and one that I'd always kind of been aware of. But it was sort of, when I got to my 30s, I thought maybe this is something I ought to be thinking about writing about, because otherwise you know, people get older and the stories disappear. And I felt it was an important story to tell.
A bit of historical context here. How did the Channel Islands end up occupied in 1940, you know, 6 months after war broke out? Why didn't the British army protect the islands from German invasion?
Well, I think the British government wanted to protect the islands, but the problem is, as you said in your introduction, they are a tiny set of islands just off the coast of France, much closer to France geographically than actually they are to England. And as a result, when the Nazis were tearing across France in the spring of 1940, the Brits realised that they just weren't going to be able to defend these islands. It was just going to be too expensive in terms of men and resources. So they withdrew. And unfortunately, that meant the islands were kind of left undefended and left to it. And a few people evacuated, but it was a very confusing time. No one knew if they should stay or if they should leave. And my family decided to stay. It was a split decision. I think in my grandparents' case, it was because they had three kids under five and they just thought it was too risky to try and leave. So they stayed. And as a result, the Nazis basically walked in. They did bomb the island initially, thinking it was still defended. But they effectively walked in and they stayed for 5 years. And what turned out to be, you know, five of the darkest years in Channel Islands history.
Mm. Your family is not Jewish. Is that correct?
They're not Jewish, no. Okay. Hedy, who the book is about, was Jewish. There were only a handful of Jews on the islands. But of course, they were much more vulnerable even than the rest of the population were. And everyone was vulnerable because anyone who stepped out of line, who challenged the authorities, who broke the rules, was likely to be punished very severely, as happened to my own family.
So people living there, at least those who were not Jewish, were allowed to stay in their homes, continue to do their jobs. In what ways did life change for your family?
Well, lots of things changed. I mean, my grandfather on my mum's side was a farmer, for example. He was thrown off his farm because the Germans wanted control of the farms. Lots of people were thrown out of their homes and forced into other accommodation. The Germans commandeered most of the food. People had to give up their cars and their cameras and their weapons, their farm animals in many cases. And then the radios were taken away, which was particularly hard. Mm. In 1942, they were taken permanently. And that meant that nobody had any access to proper communication and proper news. But my other grandfather actually made crystal radio sets for the population so they could hear what was going on outside.
Hmm.
But it was certainly a really hard time for everybody.
What did the resistance consist of among the residents of the Channel Islands?
Well, it wasn't a resistance in the sense that it was in places like France. You kind of have to use the word a little bit carefully because the islands are really tiny. Jersey is only 5 by 9 miles, and that's the largest of the islands. So there's very little that you can do without the Germans seeing you. And particularly as there were a huge amount of German troops there between 1940 and 45. Hitler was obsessed with the idea that the islands would be captured by the Allies. And so he defended them hugely.
Hmm. Which is one reason why there were so many slave workers there for building,
yes, exactly,
building fortifications.
That's why they brought the slave workers over to build fortifications.
Hmm.
So, yeah, it was a very hard period for everyone. And as I say, food was incredibly short. Medicine was very short. And
was the resistance more along the lines of finding small ways to break the rules as a way to say
it was stuff like that. As I say, my grandfather made crystal radio sets. Mm. My the other side of the family took these Russian slave workers in.
Mm.
Other people would run black market stuff, which of course wasn't always entirely selfless. There was a lot of self-interest there as well. But people would try to make sure they would smuggle food to their neighbors. They would take people in who were in trouble. They would try to hide people in lofts or in basements. But in an island that small, it's very difficult to, you know, you can't get off the island. There's no petrol. You can't get out of the harbours. So it was very difficult, and you were quite limited in terms of what you were able to do. But many people did what they could. My gran tells a fantastic story of my grandfather making crystal radio sets. And when the house was searched, she would put the radio under the baby's mattress in the baby's pram cot and go for a walk and hope that the Germans had gone when they by the time they got back, because if they'd been caught with the radios, they would have been deported.
Mm. Deported to concentration camps.
Yeah, well, that's what happened to my great uncle and my great aunt.
Did they die, by the way?
My great uncle was the only British survivor of Belsen. He actually survived the war. Mm. My great aunt, I don't want to give too much away of the film, but you can't really say too much about it without telling the story. They were betrayed, and it wasn't a happy ending for her, sadly.
I'm speaking with Jenny Lecote, who is an author and a screenwriter. She wrote a movie about her family's experience during the German occupation of the Channel Islands. That movie is called Another Mother's Son. It's available on demand. And she now has a new book. It's a novel based on the true story of two women who were on the islands during the occupation. Let's talk then about these two women. So the central character, Jenny Lecote, is Hedy Berku. And I should mention the name of the book is The Girl from the Channel Islands. Hedy Berku, as we mentioned a moment ago, was a Jewish woman living in Jersey, but not from Jersey, right? How did she give us kind of her backstory?
Okay, well, she escaped the Anschluss because her Jewish family had been hugely threatened by the German invasion of Austria. So she basically rushed to the other side of the continent. She escaped with her sister, and she was very young, very vulnerable. She ended up in Jersey, which I think she probably, like the islanders, thought this was a safe place. Hmm. It certainly seemed a long way away from where she'd come from. But as the next 2 years went on, she realised that actually it wasn't as safe as she thought, and she became trapped there when the invasion occurred. So
why was she not immediately deported as a Jew?
Well, the Germans didn't immediately deport the Jews in Jersey. There were only a few of them. The Jews were kind of rounded up over a period and deported. Hedy managed to, she was a very brave person and a very canny person, I think. And what she managed to do, she got a job working for the Germans, which is extraordinary given that she'd already been categorized as Jewish. Mm. And she used that situation to her advantage.
As a translator, because she was fluent in German,
was a translator, yes, but she would steal from them, and she would she would use that situation to help her local community, which is part of the story.
Wow.
And when that sort of turned out to be a mistake, from her perspective, she was in a very vulnerable situation, and at that stage probably would have been deported. But that is when she went into hiding with Dorothea, who's the other female character of the book.
Right.
And Dorothea really kept her alive by sheltering her in her home, because Hedy was wanted. There were posters everywhere. There was news items in the local paper. So Dorothea took a huge risk taking her in. And of course, the other part of that story was her boyfriend, Kurt, who was actually a German officer, the extraordinary part. And he brought them food and kept them alive during the war. Yeah. So there was a lot of people taking huge chances to help each other.
Tell us a little more about Dorothea. Dorothea LeBrock Weber, right, was the name of the real woman.
Yeah.
How did she end up in a position where she was able and willing to take in this, this young woman, Hedy, who was in danger?
Well, the interesting part about this for me is that really not that much is known about the real story. Mm. We know that Dorothea did take her in, but we don't know exactly how they met. We don't know how any of these people got to know each other within the islands. And we don't know what their relationships were and how those relationships developed. All we know is that they were there, and we know kind of what happened at the end of the occupation. So I had to kind of fictionalize a version where it seemed realistic that they would meet. We know that Dorothea married Anton, who was also Austrian, and that he was drafted into the German army, probably against his will. Mm. So Dorothea was left as someone who would not, as a local girl, marrying someone who would have been perceived to have been the enemy, even though he really wasn't. This would have been a very dangerous situation for her, and a very unfortunate position when you were living in a tiny community that was so divided.
The fact that she could keep Hedy hidden for more than a year, right, in her in this very small community. And
yeah, it was like a year and a half. And, you know, it's those houses along that street are not huge houses, and it's right on the edge of town. It is extraordinary that she managed to keep her hidden for that long. They must have never gone out, or only gone out under cover of darkness if they went out at all.
How was she able to get... People were on war rations at this point, right? So if Hetty wasn't even supposed to be there, if she was supposed to have, you know, died, in fact, they tried to stage her suicide to make it look like she was gone. How was Dorothea getting the supplies to feed the two of them?
Well, this is the extraordinary thing. Nobody really knows. We know that Kurt, Hetty's German officer boyfriend, helped them with food. But they were basically trying to survive on one ration. And one ration in 1943 to 1945 was barely enough to keep one person alive, never mind two. So how they survived is miraculous. Mm. They might well have had friends or family that helped them a little bit. We do know that they managed to get hold of a pig at one point, which is in the book. Mm. But there's whole sections of the story which are fictionalized because we don't really know how those things occurred. All we know is that they, you know, that somehow they got through it.
Why was starvation such a problem?
Well, the Germans would commandeer much of the food. They would take huge sections of what was harvested. They would invade the farms. They would count the number of pigs and make sure that the Germans got most of what was produced there. The farmers had ways of getting around that a little bit. They used to do things like double count the pigs. They would rush around and they would take a piglet and then put it back in the same sty, so that the Germans would double count, and then they would then when one went missing, they didn't know that one had gone missing. So there was lots of tricks around it. But yeah, I mean, food, particularly in the last year of the war, after the D-Day landings, was a really dire situation for the islands, because they were then completely cut off both from France and from England.
So the Germans on the islands were also starving then at that point.
The Germans were also starving. And as a result, they commandeered even more food and took even more from the locals. So their interest was supporting their own garrison. And many of them didn't really care. Certainly the senior Germans didn't really care if the locals lived or died. By the end of the war, there were just as many Germans who were starving and didn't want to be there and were, you know, would have been quite happy to give up and go home by that stage, I think.
Did the British government offer any attempt to relieve the suffering of these, you know, citizens of the British Isles?
No, the government didn't assist them. There was quite a famous quote from Churchill, actually, who wrote a note in the side of some notes saying, "Let them starve." And there's been a lot of dispute about that and a lot of comment about what was meant. We charitably think that perhaps he was talking about the Germans, thinking that perhaps he would starve them out. But of course, by definition, he was also starving the islanders themselves, who were British citizens. So it was, yes, it was a very contentious point. And there was, you know, a degree of contention after the war about the fact that the British and the Allies had really done very little to help them. On the other hand, there was so little they could do. The islands were enormously defended. They had vast fortifications because Hitler was so obsessed with the idea of them being recaptured. And as I say, when the D-Day landings happened, The Allies basically had to go round them and come back for them almost a year later, because it would have expended far too much of their resources to take them back then. So militarily, you can understand it. Mm. Historically, you know, there's quite a lot of emotion involved in that, I think.
Yeah, I'm sure. So the Channel Islands are independent, right? They are not governed by the British government?
Well, they're a strange little anomaly. They're called a crown dependency, which means they are part of the British Isles. They come under the authority of the Queen, but they have their own governing bodies. The states of Jersey and Guernsey are all independent governments. Mm. So they follow a lot of British rules, but they also have their own rules. So, yeah, it's kind of complicated.
Yeah. Their own culture and identity, though, as well. And
yes, and a very proud one. And they've always considered themselves very independent, which I think was why it was such a shock in 1940 to find that that independence had been taken away.
To that point, Jenny Lecote, as a native of Jersey, how did the occupation, the trauma of that occupation, How has that affected, what kind of legacy has that left? What kind of mark on the Channel Islands?
Well, I think it left a mark for some time. There was a couple of different narratives that appeared after the war. The first one, which lasted for a number of years, decades probably, was that the occupation really hadn't been too bad, and that the Jersey, the islanders had managed very, very well, very stiff upper lip. Everyone had behaved very well, and that there was nothing to see here really, and best forgotten and not to be talked about. Mm. That was probably the result of the fact that many people, like my own grandparents, did not want to discuss it very much. It had been very traumatic. They didn't want to go over it again. Then another narrative appeared in the 90s, which was kind of the opposite of that, which was that it had been a terrible occupation, but that many of the islanders had collaborated brutally with the Germans. And I don't think either of those is true. I think the truth is that there was a variety of different people. I've spoken to local Channel Island historians about this, and they said that really there were several groups of people. The majority probably just kept their head down and tried to get through it as best they could without getting into trouble. There were some that sadly did cooperate and did things like betray people who were assisting against the Germans. And there were also, I'm glad to say, people like my family who were doing everything in their limited power to resist. So it was a very mixed picture. And I think there was a trauma that was left by it. Funnily enough, the book that I'm writing now, that I've been working on for the last year, is actually set after the occupation and is trying to deal with the kind of PTSD and the trauma of what happened and how that got passed down to generations. Because being born 15 years after the end of the war, it was so easy to look at it as ancient history. And now that I'm older myself, I realise that 15 years is nothing. Those people were still living through that, just as, you know, as if it was yesterday.
Jenny Lecote has a debut novel called The Girl from the Channel Islands. It's a fictional account of real resistance during the Nazi German occupation of the Channel Islands. I spoke with her at the start of this year. This is Top of Mind Prime Cuts. It's good to have you with us. I'm Julie Rose. Coming up in about 15 minutes, how the heart muscle really does affect your emotions. Next, there's a push to build a memorial to veterans of the War on Terrorism on the National Mall in D.C., with the other war monuments, why not also build a monument there to the people who worked to prevent wars? Thanks for tuning in today to Top of Mind Prime Cuts. It's our weekly staff picks version of the show. I'm Julie Rose. In marking the anniversary of 9/11 recently, all of the still living secretaries of defense who led the Defense Department during the past 20 years published an op-ed calling for the creation of a memorial to honor those who died in the global war on terrorism. Their memories should be enshrined next to the memorials for other brave men and women who gave their lives defending this nation since its founding, they wrote. There are three major war monuments already at the National Mall in D.C., honoring veterans of World War II, the Korean War, and Vietnam. What about creating a monument there to honor people who've worked to prevent wars? Back in February, I spoke with Michael Knox, founder of the U.S. Peace Memorial Foundation. Let's listen. So who is someone who would have their name on the National Peace Memorial Monument on the National Mall? What's a name that would be on there?
Well, there would actually be quotations from famous Americans who have spoken out against war, but it would also include a lot of living Americans who have won our U.S. Peace Prize. Organizations like Veterans for Peace, Code Pink, Women for Peace, Chelsea Manning, Medea Benjamin, Noam Chomsky, Representative Dennis Kucinich, Cindy Sheehan. We have hundreds of people that we recognize in the book and on our website, and will be recognized at the U.S. Peace Memorial. But there will also be quotes from famous Americans so that people who visit the U.S. Peace Memorial will understand that it is socially acceptable to speak out against a war. If there's a war that the United States engages in and you think it's not appropriate or it's immoral, you should feel comfortable. There'll be quotes from John F. Kennedy, things like war will exist until that distant day when the conscientious objector enjoys the same reputation and prestige that the warrior does today.
This is especially a memorial then or a monument to people who oppose, to anti-war activists.
Yeah, anti-war activists, exactly. People, these are the people that we recognize in the book and on our website and will be recognized on the memorial. But then we have people who have engaged in cultural and leadership and historic positions in the United States who at some point in their career said some anti-war things that are strong, people like Margaret Mead, Ralph Waldo Emerson. Albert Einstein said, I believe that the killing of human beings in a war is no better than common murder.
So could a U.S. president, I mean, you just mentioned John F. Kennedy Jr., but yeah. I mean, while he was in office, America was at war in Vietnam.
Of course.
And so could a U.S. president ever actually be, recognized by the U.S. Peace Memorial Foundation?
No, not recognized the way we recognize anti-war people, but a quotation from Kennedy may have an impact on people who remember him and what he did and look up to him and see that he, at some point in his life, opposed war. It goes back to George Washington. There are people who have, and Eisenhower, certainly.
Hmm. Michael Knox, what's the point of a memorial like this? I mean, everybody opposes war. Peace is always the goal, but war is a necessary evil. Why do we need a monument to people who would rather not have war? Isn't that everybody?
No, it's certainly not everybody. Everyone would certainly raise their hand and say they support peace. But the key is that Americans, for one reason or another, are not as aware of what our country is doing in the way of war as they should be. The U.S. has bombed no less than 30 countries since the end of World War II. We've killed millions of people. We've maimed tens of millions more. That's 30 countries in 74 years, 75 years. So we're disrupting education, healthcare, housing, businesses, infrastructure, the environment in these countries. And since 1946, no other country has killed and injured more people living outside of its borders. And I encourage your listeners to look into that. They can look at the book or look at our website, but we name every country that the U.S. has invaded since World War II. I think most people would say that they can't think of a good reason for that invasion, how these people were a threat to us, to our country, to our way of life. And yet that's what the government sells to us. When you think of all the wars, you think maybe it's time to honor those who oppose war.
I'm speaking with Michael Knox, who is founder of the U.S. Peace Memorial Foundation. They do an annual U.S. Peace Prize. And he's written a new book about the effort and also his hopes for an actual monument on the National Mall. The book is called Ending U.S. Wars by Honoring Americans Who Work for Peace. Mr. Knox, a war memorial, and especially those that are on the National Mall, there are names of people who have sacrificed in the ultimate way in some cases, or, you know, who've died, who are missing in action, who are seriously injured. What is the sacrifice involved in being against war?
Well, people who oppose war, many of the people who have received our U.S. Peace Prize or who are honored in the U.S. Peace Registry have been arrested multiple times, some hundreds of times. They've been gassed, pepper sprayed in the eyes, electroshocked, tasered, I meant, beat up by the police, imprisoned, home invasions where they're arrested in the middle of the night, the cost of attorney fees and bail, fines, loss of income, and certainly loss of friends. There was a period in my life where my parents wouldn't even speak to me because they were so upset by my opposition to the war in Vietnam. So you can lose a job, you can lose a promotion, certainly not the ultimate sacrifice, but if we move towards peace, then fewer Americans will die. And if fewer Americans die, there'll be less less need for these kinds of monuments to honor their death. And that really is the ultimate goal, to make peace a priority, have a culture of peace rather than a culture of war.
What do you mean a culture of war?
Well, so many aspects of our country have to do with war, with whether it's education or even think of President Biden, his inauguration address, his speech that he gave after his presidential victory, and his nomination acceptance speech for the Democratic Party. He ended all those speeches with reference to the military. May God protect our troops. And that was consistent with what Obama did, where he was always pointing out people in the audience who had uniforms or asking people to stand who were in the military and saying that they were the best this country had to offer, that they were true American heroes. And we want to change that a little bit so that the people who are working for peace are also recognized for what they have done and what they've sacrificed.
You envision a situation where anti-war activists who maybe picketed outside the White House in opposition to a war somewhere that we're involved in, that those individuals would be thanked for their service at public events, would be given, I don't know, priority boarding on airplanes like members of the military? I mean, do you?
Well, absolutely. But I think we have to go beyond that. Until COVID, we weren't even thanking healthcare workers. At public gatherings, no matter what you attend, a city council meeting, a religious service, an athletic event, you know, basketball or football, whatever it is, a university event, they're always asking veterans to stand. They're always honoring the veterans. We should share that and, you know, ask the teachers to stand or the farmers to stand or the healthcare providers, as we're doing a little bit more. But we're always tying it into the military, every aspect of our life, even the military, the fighter jet flyovers that went across the country at great expense to honor the healthcare workers, was trying to tie in healthcare. We're doing a terrible job of COVID, and we weren't treating it like a war. And yet they're trying to tie it into the military in some way. And those are just some examples of our culture.
What's the effect of that? Help me understand why it's a bad thing to honor the men and women in uniform at the beginning of a football game or to say God bless our troops at the end of a speech.
Well, I mean, this is militarism. The reason that we do that, let me just explain, is that during the Obama administration, the NFL leagues were paid money to have patriotic halftime ceremonies honoring the soldiers. The New England Patriots got $1 million in 1 year to do that. And this, you know, this is a matter of public record. This started it. So once you do it in the NFL, colleges pick it up, high schools pick it up, and it's all part of reinforcing the militarism in the United States. So the people think it must be acceptable to go to war. But you think about the 30 countries, the millions of people that we've killed. And for every person we kill, there are 10 to 12 people who are severely injured that will have injuries for the rest of their life that will debilitate them in some way. And then you have, when people die in these countries, these millions of people that we've killed in Korea and Vietnam. Right now, we're bombing people in Afghanistan, Pakistan, Iraq, Somalia, Libya, Yemen, and Syria. We need to learn more about what the United States is doing and stop accepting this culture of war where militarism is so prevalent.
So, Michael Knox, are you saying that you think America should never come to the defense of an ally somewhere, or that we should not have retaliated for the 9/11 terror attacks, that it's never okay to wage war even to protect the weak or vulnerable or the democratically elected government of a country?
Well, that's a complex question. I think that if there were United Nations where the countries could come together and even override the Security Council and make a decision about which countries need this protection, that would be a good idea. But I don't think the United States should be protecting other people without the United Nations getting involved. But in terms of the 9/11 bombings, I mean, the 17 of the 19 perpetrators of that crime were from Saudi Arabia. And we didn't invade Saudi Arabia. It's Afghanistan, Pakistan, Iraq, Somalia, Libya, Yemen, and Syria. We have other reasons for invading those countries. I don't know what they are, but it certainly is not in retribution for 9/11. It's always some excuse like weapons of mass destruction. And we need to use critical thinking. American people need to look at these wars and decide for themselves, is this a reason for spending our money? And are there better ways to spend our money? All of our activities, education, housing, healthcare, everything that the government provides pales in comparison to what we spend on militarism.
Michael Knox, in order to get a monument to peacemakers on the National Mall in Washington, D.C., you'll need support from Congress. Have you ever managed to get any traction, any sponsor in Congress? What is the reaction when you ask for this?
Well, we're not asking for it yet. We are building the foundation. We plan to have 1,000 founding members representing all 50 states before we go public and make these requests. The Martin Luther King Memorial, which is a recent one, took over 25 years to build. It costs over $120 million to build. We have a ways to go, but our first benchmark is that we have people join the foundation and that we have 1,000 people representing all 50 states. And at that point, we will go forward and make these requests and raise funds. What we're trying to do is to reinforce those who engage in anti-war behavior so they'll continue to do it, hold them up as role models so that others will do it. And having a national monument will make it clear to the American people that it is socially acceptable to oppose one or more wars. This is not a monument for pacifists. If you felt that any of the wars we've engaged in are wrong, you should oppose it. And that opposition does not have to be anything too active. You could write a letter to the editor in your local newspaper. You could write to your member of Congress. And there's a broad spectrum of things that people have engaged in. We've identified in the book 900 specific anti-war activities that people have engaged in. And they go from that writing an attitude to civil disobedience that often leads in arrest, but it's always nonviolent. And I think that's the key to any kind of protest.
Michael Knox is a professor emeritus at the University of South Florida. He's founder of the U.S. Peace Memorial Foundation and author of Ending U.S. Wars by Honoring Americans Who Work for Peace. We spoke back in February of this year. This is Top of Mind Prime Cuts. Coming up next, the heart is not just the symbolic center of our emotions. Its rhythm actually affects emotions. This is Top of Mind Prime Cuts. It's great to have you with us. I'm Julie Rose. We always talk about the heart as if it plays a part in our emotions, even though it's just a muscle. Our hearts can be full of love or sink in disappointment. Something can be heartfelt. Those are not just sayings, though. The heart actually does influence your emotions. Sarah Garfinkel has conducted multiple studies on this. She's a professor of clinical and affective neuroscience at Brighton and Sussex Medical School in England. Garfinkel spoke with Top of Mind's Ciara Hewlett about 4 months ago.
Wouldn't it be the other way around, that our heart is influenced by our emotions, like how it beats faster if we're nervous?
And that's certainly what most people think, that you are scared and then your heart races. But actually, I'm very much of the perspective, and others are as well, such as William James in 1884, who first sort of really talked about it being the other direction, that you feel emotion because you sense the changes in your body. So fear arises from sensing your pounding heart beat fast rather than that being a reflection of your fear.
What? That's so weird. So if I was going to give a public speech and I was nervous, it's because my heart was beating faster and then I feel nervous.
And then you sense it. Well, this is what I think, like, what is emotion and what gives a sort of feelingness of emotion? And I would argue that sort of cold cognition and the thinking aspects are differentiated from the emotion, because emotion involves the sensing of these bodily sensations. And it's those sensing, it's the neural sensing, it's the conscious sensing, it's the influence of those bodily sensations, which gives rise to the feeling part of the emotional state.
How would that be that if my heart is beating faster, then I get nervous?
So then you feel nervous, I guess, is what I would say. And it's the feeling part. And there's this beautiful dynamic relationship between the organs in our body and our brain. So our brains tell our organs what to do, but our organs also feed back to the brain and tell the brain how they are. So every time your heart beats, it sends a signal to your brain. And the faster and the stronger your heart is beating, the more that signal will be. So your organs can beautifully impact on neural activity as well. So if something terrible happens, then your heart might jump. Your brain has told your heart to jump. And you do see these sort of delays or accelerations in heart rate. So your brain can do that and tell the organs what to do, but the organs then act differently and feed back to the brain. And it's the sensing of those bodily changes that gives rise to the emotional part.
So there's something bad happens. And so in my brain, I know this, but I may not feel it yet in my emotions. And so then my brain tells my heart to start pounding faster. And then when I feel my heart start pounding faster, that's when I feel scared.
Yeah, that's exactly how I'd say it.
Okay. But why then is the brain telling my heart to pound faster when something bad happens?
So your brain tells your body to get into different emotional body states, which can prioritize different types of functioning. So when your heart is beating stronger and faster, then you are sensitive to threats in the environment, you're hypervigilant, and that is adaptive. If you are looking out for a threat and you're in a threat state, you also have pain reduced. So you have reduced pain sensitivity, so you can potentially run over the broken twigs and glass to get away from a threat when your heart is beating strong and fast. So your body prioritizes different cognitive, physical, and attention states by being in a different bodily state. But the feelings and how they arise, I would argue, comes from the sensing of these bodily sensations.
And how do you know that? How do you know that the feeling then comes from the heart pounding faster and not before?
Oh, this is a great question. I love this question. So there's something that I study is called interoception, which is defined as the sensing of internal bodily sensations. So this can be the rumble of your stomach or the racing of your heart or butterflies in your stomach, that sort of jittery feeling. The sensing of internal body sensations is known as interoception. And some people are very, very good at this and very accurate at it, and other people are not so accurate. And you can see big individual differences in who are really accurate at it and how they experience emotion. So people who are very sensitive to bodily changes are people who feel emotions with a greater intensity.
Oh, okay. So people who can feel their heartbeat have stronger emotion?
Yes. So there's been studies that have shown this. So if I characterize people in who are very good heartbeat detectors and who are poorer or less accurate at this, and then I get you to watch emotional films designed to elicit anger, fear, or amusement, then you rate the intensity of how emotionally intense you found those films. If you're someone who's very accurate at detecting when your heart is beating, you'll rate the films as more intense. And these experiments have been done.
Huh. So what determines someone who's good at being able to feel their heartbeat and someone who's not? Do they just have a stronger heartbeat?
So it's not just the strength of the heartbeat, it's also influenced by the brain. So we know there's a part of the brain called the anterior insula, particularly on the right-hand side. And this area is very active when you are trying to sense bodily sensations. And those individuals who have higher activity in this area are more accurate at detecting internal bodily sensations. And also those people who have a larger gray matter volumes, this area is a bit bigger in some people, they're also more accurate at detecting bodily sensations. So it seems to be a real individual difference characteristic.
So some people just are more aware of their bodily sensations and their heartbeat than other people. It's not necessarily that their heartbeat is stronger.
It's not necessarily that their heartbeat is stronger, just like you say. And aware is an interesting word because it also sort of includes attention. And that's another individual difference. Like some people just attend to their body a lot and they may be more aware by virtue of the extra attention. But what we're really interested in is this accuracy or this precision measure that when you're attending to your bodily sensations, so you've taken attention out as another variable, then just some people are much more accurate than others at doing this. And you can also see when this goes wrong. So alexithymia is a condition where individuals have trouble understanding how they feel. They have difficulty identifying their own feelings and detecting their own feelings, and they tend to be focused more on the world and the body. And these individuals have poor interoceptive accuracy, so have reduced accuracy or precision into what's going on in their body. And this supports the idea that those individuals who are poor at this then don't really know how they're feeling, while at the other end of the spectrum, those people are really, really accurate at this, can feel emotions quite intensely.
I'm speaking with Sarah Garfinkel. She's a professor of clinical and effective neuroscience at the University College London. And then you also did a study that people who are like work in finance, like on Wall Street, they do better if they can feel their heart rate.
Yeah. Oh, this is wild. So the interception is linked to so many things. Yes, this is instinctive decision making. So have you ever made a decision where you're like, if you're choosing between two things and you're like, I don't know why, but this other one just feels right.
Yeah, the gut feeling.
Yeah, the gut instincts is what we call it in England. And we were interested to see whether there's a biological basis to this gut instinct and whether this might also be connected to the sensing of bodily sensations. So I worked in the London Stock Exchange with a group of traders, and these were high frequency traders who make very, very fast split second decisions about whether to trade or not trade. And they'll often say that they go on gut instinct. And what we found was that these individuals who were very good at trading and instinctive decision making were more accurate at detecting internal bodily sensations than those traders who were less good at making these decisions.
That's so weird.
And it builds on work in Cambridge by Tim Dalgleish. And this is one of my most favorite studies in the whole world, which is again looking at instinctive decision making, but looking in the lab. And he set up a complex algorithm underlying which was the right decision and which was the wrong one. So if I asked you which is the right one and which is the wrong one, you wouldn't know. You'd have no conscious awareness. It's a very complex algorithm. However, if I monitor your heart, then your heart starts having different patterns to the good thing relative to the bad thing. So your heart knows before your mind realizes. And those individuals of better interception were more able to use this cardiac signal to help guide them to make good decisions.
How?
Oh, you see, this is what I mean. This is why sensing the heartbeats, like sensing it, offers a new channel of information. And this is what's so cool about the heart and different levels of conscious awareness. Like you can not know something with your mind and with your prefrontal cortex and with your sort of conscious assessment, but you can still feel instinctively that this is the answer, but you don't know why. And what's wild is your body is telling you in some cases which the thing is, and you have levels of understanding, and this implicit level can be represented in the body.
You're right. Cool. It is wild. It's so cool. Yeah.
And there's other things as well. I don't know if you want me to list all the things interception are. So there's eating, like instinctive eating. So those people who know when they're hungry and those people who don't. So those people who can be really guided by hunger signals have more healthy eating patterns and a lower BMI. And again, this is being guided by sensations from the body.
Could you also use this research to help people who maybe have too much emotion, like anxiety or depression, or maybe someone with autism who can't recognize their emotions very well? Could you help someone be better at recognizing their internal bodily signals and their heartbeat, and then to help them with some of these emotional issues?
This is a great question, and we've actually just finished a clinical trial looking at anxiety in individuals who are autistic, and we're interested in trying to help autistic individuals better understand their own bodies so they could regulate their own anxiety. So this is something that we've been doing a lot, and autistic individuals are so interesting when it comes to their bodily profile, because they often have a really big bodily empathy response. So their empathy in their body is actually higher than individuals who are not autistic, but sometimes they have trouble understanding what their body is doing. So they either don't feel it, or they're so overwhelmed by their body that they don't feel things sort of accurately and precisely, because they just feel it so intensely. So we've been training autistic individuals to have better access to these bodily signals when they're fainter. So when their heart just starts to ramp up, can they notice this sooner? And we're helping them then regulate their body as a means to help them control their anxiety. And anxiety is really, really comorbid with autism spectrum conditions. So 60%-ish of the autistic community that we've been working with also has an anxiety disorder. So helping them understand what their body is doing and helping them better regulate really does seem to help them control their own anxiety.
So would it be just in recognizing, okay, my heart is beating faster now, that's why I'm feeling this way, that's why I'm feeling anxious, rather than I feel anxious, oh my gosh, I feel anxious?
Yeah, both are true. So if you know it's your heart, then you can attribute it to an internal cause rather than attributing it to an external cause. So you can realize it's you, not the world. And early access to that signal means just as it's starting to ramp up, it's easier to regulate. Whereas if you only become aware of your beating heart when it's racing, you're already in the middle of a panic attack, it's very hard to regulate it. So an early and precise insight into what it's doing can help you at an earlier stage where it's easier to control.
Sarah Garfinkel is a professor of clinical and affective neuroscience at Brighton and Sussex Medical School. She spoke with Top of Mind's Ciara Hewlett back in May. And that's it for Top of Mind Prime Cuts. Thanks for tuning in today. It's been great having you along. Top of Mind is a production of BYU Radio. Cleon Wall, Ciara Hewlett, and Kyle Raymond produced the show. We'd love to connect with you on social media. Find us at BYU Top of Mind on Twitter, Instagram, and Facebook. You can listen on demand and find previous episodes of the show by subscribing to our podcast. Just look for Top of Mind on your favorite podcast app for new episodes daily. Or ask your smart speaker to play the Top of Mind podcast. I'm Julie Rose. We'll talk soon.